movement to theatre almost immediately. We may need to wire his jaw, and there are several broken teeth which we'll have to clean up. He'll be sedated when he comes out, so there isn't any point in your staying. They both rose, and my mother leant over and kissed me on the forehead.
We'll see you tomorrow morning, darling. You be a brave boy now.
My grandpa touched me lightly on the shoulder.
There's a good lad, he said.
I watched them leave the emergency ward, where I appeared to be the only emergency, as the other three beds were unoccupied. My jaw ached a great deal, and while I think I may have been crying, I only recall being terribly concerned for Doc. It turned out my jaw had been broken. They wired the top jaw to the bottom one in the closed mouth position, so I was unable to talk. I couldn't inquire about him. Adults decide what they want kids to know, and all my mother would say when she came to visit was,
"You've had a terrible shock, darling. You mustn't think about what happened."
In fact, that was all I could think about. Doc was the most important person in my life, and the thought of him lying in a dark cell, probably dying, was almost unbearable. I managed to communicate to a junior nurse called Marie, who had taken to calling me her little scutterball, that I wanted paper and a pencil. She brought a pad and pencil, and in running writing I wrote,
"What's happened to Professor von Fallenstein?"
She read the note, and her eyes grew large.
"Ach, no, man. Sister says we can't tell you nothing."
She held out her hand for the pad and pencil, but I quickly tucked it under the quilt.
"Give it to me back. Please, I'll get into trouble with sister."
I shook my head, which hurt.
"I'll tell on you, you hear?"
But I knew she wouldn't. I felt less vulnerable with the pad and pencil beside me. I tore a single sheet from the small pad and brought it out from under the bedclothes. Placing it on the cabinet beside my bed, I leant over and wrote,
"My name is not Scatterball. It is P.K.
I didn't much like the endearment, as I didn't see myself as a fluffy ball, which is a name you give to really small kids. I tore the bit I'd written on from the sheet of paper and handed it to her. She read it slowly, then walked to the end of the bed.
"That's not what it says here,"
Marie said, looking down at the progress chart, which hung from the foot of the bed.
"Don't you know your proper name, then?"
she teased.
"It's wrong,"
I scribbled, tearing off a second note and holding it out to her.
"Sus, man, you don't even know your own name. I never heard of a name like P.K. Where'd you get a silly name like that?"
On the remaining scrap of paper, I wrote,
"I just got it."
Marie took a sharp breath.
"Anyway, it's a rotten name for a hero who tackled a German spy when he was trying to escape."
Her eyes grew big again, and she moved her spotty face close to mine.
"It says in the paper, you even may be going to get a medal."
She drew back suddenly, alarmed that she told me too much.
"Don't you tell sister I told you, you hear?"
She brought a finger up to her lips.
"I promise I'll call you PK, if you promise to stay stum."
I nodded my head, though I wondered how she thought I could tell anyone. The tears began to roll down my cheeks. I hadn't wanted them to, they just came because of the news about Doc. I could hear his voice when the officer had handed him the piece of paper.
"Their stupidity. Already their stupidity begins again."
"Don't cry, PK. Sister'll know I told you if you cry,"
Marie said, distressed. I knuckled the tears from my eyes, and then she bathed my face with a wet flannel.
"I don't really think PK is a silly name," she said gently. "Who showed you how to write so good? I went to school up to 14, and even I can't write so good as you."
After 3 days alone in the ward, I was moved onto the veranda where there were 8 beds all occupied. Except for the fact that I still couldn't talk, I was much better. I had walked into the ward with the sister, and with the exception of 2 old men who were asleep, all the others had applauded and said things like, "Well done, son." One man said that I was a proper patriot. As soon as sister left the ward, I wrote on a piece of paper as big as I could, "What happened to Professor von Fallenstein?" I jumped out of bed and took it over to the bed nearest me and gave it to the man in it. He read it and handed it back to me.
"You mean the German spy? Sorry, son, we're not supposed to tell you."
He winked at the others.
"We got strict orders."
The others all nodded.
"Mind you, you're a brave little bugger, I have to say that for you."
The other men seemed to agree with him. My mother came to the hospital in the mornings when Pastor Mulvery was able to bring her. She sat with me while he went around the hospital to witness for the Lord. But first he came in to see me, and he'd flash his lightning smile, which prevented his two front teeth from escaping, and held my hand in his damp, warm grasp for ages, until it felt as though it wanted to jump out of his soft grip and run away and hide. In his soft woman's voice, he said,
"We are all praying that this terrible ordeal will make you accept Jesus into your heart."
Then, still holding my hand, he knelt beside the bed, and my mother also knelt on the other side, and Pastor Mulvery would pray out loud. When he prayed, his voice rose even higher, and he became quite excited. He would start with a few random hallelujahs, and my mother would respond with, "Praise his name! Praise his precious name!" And Pastor Mulvery would say, "Lord, we are gathered here in your precious name to pray for this poor child."
"Amen,"
my mother would say.
"In his terrible affliction, show him the path to salvation. Oh, precious Redeemer who died on the cross so that we might be free."
"Hallelujah, praise the Lord,"
my mother would answer.
"Son, open your heart to Jesus. Accept him into your life. Lord, do not condemn him to the terrible fires of hell. Grant him everlasting life with your glorious salvation."
"Hallelujah, blessed be his name."
"Bring your sin to Jesus, son. Lay it at his feet so that he may grant you his precious redemption. Precious Jesus, answer our prayers. Open his young heart. Let him see you in all your glory. Lord, we pray for this child's soul. We earnestly beseech you to bring him from darkness to the light, from the inky black of the stone tomb on Golgotha, into the glorious morning of the resurrection of our sweet Jesus Christ."
"Yes, Jesus, precious Jesus,"
my mother would be saying on her side of the bed, and so it would go every morning. Not long after I'd first met Doc, we were sitting on our rock on the hill behind the rose garden, and I had asked him why I was a sinner, and what I had done to be condemned to eternal hellfire unless I was born again. He sat for a long time looking over the valley, and then he said,
"PK, God is too busy making the sun come up and go down, and watching so the moon floats just right in the sky, to be concerned with such rubbish. Only man wants always God should be there to condemn this one and save that one. Always it is man who wants to make heaven and hell. God is too busy training the bees to make honey and every morning opening up all the new flowers for business."
He paused and smiled.
"In Mexico, there's a cactus that even sometimes you would think God forgets. But no, my friend, this is not so. On a full moon in the desert every 100 years, he remembers. And he opens up a single flower to bloom. And if you should be there, and you see this beautiful cactus blossom, painted silver by the moon and laughing up at the stars, this, PK, is heaven."
He looked at me, his deep blue eyes sharp and penetrating.
"This is the faith in God the cactus has."
We had sat for a while before he spoke again.
"It is better just to get on with the business of living and minding your own business. And maybe if God likes the way you do things, he may just let you flower for a day or night. But don't go pestering and begging and telling him all your stupid little sins. That way you'll spoil his day. Absolutely."
I still sometimes got a bit scared about going to hell, and I used to think quite a lot about being born again. But my heart didn't want to open up and receive the Lord. All the people I knew who had opened up their hearts to Jesus struck me as a pretty pathetic lot. Not bad, not good, just nothing. I couldn't afford to be just nothing when I was aiming to be the welterweight champion of the world. I guess my mother was right when she said if I kept rejecting the Lord and hardening my heart, one day he might just go away and leave me to it. That's what must have happened, because after a while it got a lot easier, and I didn't worry as much. I decided I liked Doc's God a lot more than my mother's and Pastor Mulvery's and Peak Porter's and all the people who loved Jesus at the Apostolic Faith Mission. Jesus, who was God's dearly beloved Son, seemed to be in charge of things there. He seemed to be very keen on saving souls and had actually died for their sins, but I couldn't help feeling it may have been a bit of a waste. Still, they seemed pretty grateful because they spoke a lot more about Jesus than about God. Jesus was definitely number one at the Apostolic Faith Mission. Later I was to learn that there was a third party involved called the Holy Ghost, who spoke in tongues of invisible fire, and he gave people a thing called the gift of tongues. When he did this, people would jump up in prayer meetings and wave their arms around and shake a lot with their eyes closed. They never seemed to bump into anything either. It was quite uncanny. And they'd babble away and sing using strange words. I'd tried to do it afterwards, but it never sounded right. It was a gift, all right. A visiting pastor from the Assembly of God Church in America told us once, when we were having a revival week, that he had definite proof that a woman who had never been out of her small town in America spoke in Swahili when the Holy Ghost entered into her. There was a missionary from Africa who understood Swahili present in the same small church in America, and she'd understood every word. He didn't tell us what she said, but he said there were lots of cases like this, and that he'd personally witnessed quite a few. I had listened from then on, but nobody in the Apostolic Faith Mission ever spoke Zulu or Shangaan. Maybe Zulu and Shangaan weren't exotic enough for the Holy Ghost. I wondered what was so special about Swahili. Pastor Mulvery got up from beside the hospital bed and gave me a flash smile and said that Jesus loved me anyway. Then he trotted off with the Bible under one arm and a handful of tracts to visit all the other patients, and my mother called him a precious man and stayed with me. After I got the pad, I wrote her a long note asking her about Doc. She took it and, without reading it, asked,
"Is this about the professor?"
Her lips were drawn tight as I nodded. Then she scrunched the note in her hand.
"I don't want you ever to mention his name again, do you hear? He's an evil man who used you to cover up the terrible things he was doing, and then he nearly killed you."
There were sudden tears in her eyes.
"The doctor says if he had caught you on the side of the head, he would have killed you. Another 3 inches and you would have been dead. You've been through a terrible experience, and I've prayed and prayed the Lord will make you forget it, so you're not scarred for life."
She wiped her eyes and blew her nose.
"No, no,"
I forced myself to say. What came out was sort of two squeaks from the back of my throat, which forced their way past my bruised and swollen tongue and out of my clamped mouth. I started to cry silently without wanting to in front of my mother. They were blaming Doc for what had happened to me, and I was the only one who knew the truth, and I couldn't help him. It was my fault anyway. If I hadn't put the bottle of Johnny Walker in his sugar bag, this never would have happened. Doc, whom I loved so dearly, had become another Piscop victim. This time it was much worse than a nervous breakdown. My mother had stopped sniffing when she saw my tears.
"You poor little mite. You've been through a terrible time. We'll never talk about it again. Mrs. Boxall from the library has asked to come and see you, but the doctor and I have agreed that you're not well enough to have visitors."
She opened her bag and withdrew a green folded card.
"Now I have some good news for you. Your report card came, and you came first in your class. Your grandpa and I are very proud of you."
She beamed at me, her tears forgotten.
"They've put you up another 2 classes. You're going to be in with the 10-year-olds. Fancy that. 7 and in with the 10-year-olds.
She handed the report card to me, and through my tears, I took it and tore it into 4 pieces. For a long time, my mother said nothing, looking down at the pieces of green cardboard in my lap. Finally, she gave a deep sigh. I hated her sighs the most because they made me feel terribly guilty.
"Oh, the Lord has blessed you with a good brain. I pray every day that you will take him into your heart and use your fine mind to glorify his precious name."
She gathered the pieces up and dropped them into her handbag, giving me a sort of squiffy smile.
"I'm sure it can be mended. You are just not your old cheerful self at present, are you?"
But her eyes weren't smiling as she spoke. That afternoon I wrote a note to Mrs. Boxall at the library. All it said was,
"Please come, in the afternoon,"
and I signed it. I also wrote a note for Marie asking her if she would take the note to Mrs. Boxall at the Barberton Public Library. Marie had switched midweek to night duty and came on at 6 p.m. without dinner. I handed her the note. She read it and quickly hid it in the pocket of her white starched junior nurse's uniform.
She picked up my dinner tray from the trolley and brought it over to me.
I'll only do it if it's got nothing to do with that spy,
she whispered as she put my tray down in front of me. I handed her the second note. She gave me a suspicious look as she took it.
I got to read it first before I say I'll do it.
She read the note and seemed assured by its contents.
I've got my day off tomorrow. I'll do it then. Now promise you'll eat your pumpkin. You left it last night, and also your peas.
She seated herself on the side of the bed, and taking up a teaspoon, she filled it with pumpkin and put it through the hole in the corner of my mouth. I had lost 4 top and bottom teeth on the same side, where the sergeant's boot had landed, and Marie called it my feeding hole. She was the best of anyone at getting the mashed food they were beginning to give me through the hole without making my gums bleed. I spent the rest of the evening writing to Mrs. Boxall a long, detailed description of what had happened. Doc, when I presented him with my botanical notes, would always stress that a botanist is concerned with detail.
Observation is what makes a scientist, he said. It is only by seeing things in minute detail that we learn their secrets. Others can walk past a plant for a whole life and never even notice the color of its blossoms, but the botanist knows every beat of its heart and turning of petal.
And so I wrote it all down just the way it happened, even the swear words, and then I hid the 3 sheets of paper in my pillow slip. Mrs. Boxall came the very next afternoon. In her string bag she carried a new William book by Richmal Crompton, a book called Flowers from the Banks of the Zambezi by Reverend William Barton of the London Missionary Society, and 3 copies of National Geographic.
You are such a precocious child, P.K. I hope they suit your Catholic taste.
Like Doc, Mrs. Boxall never talked down to me, with the result that I didn't always understand her and wondered what the Catholics might have to do with my taste. I withdrew my notes from inside the pillow and handed them to Mrs. Boxall.
Well now, pray, what have we here? She said, taking the 3 pages and reaching into her bag for her glasses.
She read for a long time, and then read the 3 pages again, before looking up at me.
Remarkable. You are a remarkable child. This comes just in time. A military court is being convened next week, and things are looking pretty grim for our professor, my dear. The whole jolly town is up in arms about him. People are seeing jerrys in their chamber pots.
She chuckled at her own joke.
I tried to see him in prison, but those dreadful Boers said only authorized people could see him. If a librarian isn't an authorized person, then who is, I ask you? But the stupid warder at the gate wouldn't budge. I've started a petition in the library, but so far I only have 12 signatures, and 3 of them are Boers, and we all know where their sympathies lie, do we not? That dreadful little man, Georgie Hankin, has threatened to say some perfectly ghastly things about me in Goldfield News, and has told me privately that if I persist, he can't have a Nazi sympathizer writing a column in his newspaper. Honestly. You'd think it was the Times of London, the way he carries on about that dreadful little rag.
She paused, dug once more into her string bag, and withdrew a copy of the Goldfield News. Taking up almost half the front page was Doc's picture of me sitting on the rock. Above the picture in huge black letters it said, "The Boy He Tried to Kill." Just above the headline, below the masthead, was written, "Special Spy Edition." Under the picture, the caption read, "Like Abraham's biblical sacrifice of Isaac, the innocent boy waits on the rock." No doubt Georgie Hankin, who as usual had it all wrong, saw this as his finest professional hour. Doc's arrest had occurred just in time for the weekly edition, which appeared on a Monday. It carried the original news of the arrest, and this special 2-page mid-week edition, using precious ration newsprint, was an attempt by Mr. Hankin to achieve immortality in his profession. The reason Mrs. Boxall hadn't been able to visit me was because Dr. Simpson, in resisting Georgie and his photographer's attempts to come and see me, had banned all visitors. She was surprised that I hadn't seen the earlier paper and promised to bring it the following afternoon. Though as a trained librarian, she had little trouble verbally reproducing the essence and the flavor of Monday's big story. The essence of the story reported in the news was that the provost officer and his sergeant had waited most of the afternoon for Doc to arrive. When he appeared with a small boy in tow, he was in a disheveled state, and it was obvious to the 2 military policemen that he had been drinking. The sergeant, on the orders of the officer,
escorted him back to his cottage to allow him to clean up, whereupon, when his back was turned, Doc attacked the sergeant with a heavy metal-topped walking stick and attempted to run for the hills. It was pointed out that Doc knew the hills well and would easily be able to conceal himself indefinitely in one of the hundreds of disused mine shafts dotted all through the mountains. He would then make his way across the mountains to Lorenzo Marks, the nearest neutral territory. The story had gone on to say that the sergeant was stunned from the blows he had received, and it looked as though Doc would make good his escape, had it not been for me, who had bravely tackled him. Hearing my scream, the officer had rushed down the path, just in time to see Doc take a vicious kick at my head. The officer arrested the suspected spy at the point of his pistol. The editorial went on to point out that Doc was a noted photographer, and that under the guise of photographing cactus, he had undoubtedly taken pictures of likely enemy landing places and established landmarks and mine shafts for storing food and weapons for enemy spies infiltrating South Africa from Portuguese territory. The paper pointed out that there were no pictures to be found of such places, confirming that they had already reached the enemy and that no clever spy would leave such incriminating evidence around. Fortuitously, inside the expensive German Leica camera the spy had used that very afternoon, was exposed film of a hole in the mountainside, with the ore tailings dug from the mine heaped directly outside the shaft, making it an ideal defensive position. In Doc's notepad had been found a compass bearing and exact location of the disused mine. There had also been several pictures of a succulent, which proved how cunning and careful to cover up Doc had been. The picture was, of course, the site where we had found Senecio serpens, the blue chalk sticks. The remainder of the exposed pictures on Doc's film had been of the succulent. Doc, as he had taught me to do, always established the location of a find, the direction of the prevailing winds, by studying the bush and larger plants in the immediate area, the soil conditions and the surrounding rock types. To the rumour-happy folk of Barberton it was all very feasible, and few of them paused long enough to examine the evidence or to question the town's 15-year relationship with Doc. Mrs. Boxall said people were going around saying, "Once a Jerry, always a Jerry," satisfied that this covered a multitude of sins.
"Goodness, P.K., I'd suspect my dear old father before I'd suspect the Professor. He doesn't have a patriotic bone in his body unless it's for Africa and has something to do with cactus."
She folded my notes carefully and placed them in her handbag.
"Oh, dear, I nearly forgot. I bought you a bag of gobstoppers." "Oh, my goodness," she said in an alarmed voice. "I'd quite forgotten about your jaw. What an idiot I am."
She dropped the rock-hard candy into her bag and clipped it shut and leant over and touched me on the chin.
"Chin up, old chap. We've got all the evidence we need to get our mutual friend out of trouble. I'll get back tomorrow with the news."
She was gone, her sensible brogue shoes clattering on the polished cement floor, her back straight as a ramrod and her bobbed head held high. I could hear her still clattering down the veranda long after she was out of sight. For the first time in a week I felt happy. Mrs. Boxall was not the sort to be trifled with, and I had every confidence that she'd sort things out. She was Doc's friend and mine as well, and as Doc had so often said, "This woman, she is not a fool, P.K." But I didn't see Mrs. Boxall the next day. Somehow my mother had heard of her visit and had seen Dr. Simpson, who brought down a ban on visitors again. I had begun to make semi-intelligent sounds through my wired jaw, and Marie, after a few trial sessions, had little trouble understanding me. She said she had a little brother who was a bit wonky in the head, and I sounded a lot like him, which made it easy for her to understand me. It was nice to talk to someone again, and it was Marie who told me about my mother's visit to Dr. Simpson, which she overheard while she was in the dispensary. My mother said nothing to me the morning after she had visited the doctor, and I was once again cut off without any news. Marie also told me that I would be going home on Tuesday, and she was quite sad about it. She was 15 years old and came from a farm in the valley. She only got one weekend a month off to go home. She lived in the nurse's home while all the other juniors lived in town. She wasn't very pretty or very clever, and she had pimples, which she called her terrible spots, so she didn't have any friends. I told her I was her friend, and if she liked, she could come into the hills with me. She seemed a bit worried about that and said girls weren't supposed to go climbing hills, but she'd like to come anyway. On the Monday evening she came into the ward and put a large brown paper bag on the bed. She brought a finger to her lips, signalling for me to say nothing.
"Mrs. Boxall brought it to the nurse's home. She says it's the latest on you-know-what,"
she whispered, thrilled to be part of the conspiracy but also frightened. Then later, when she was feeding me, she said,
"I did nothing wrong, did I? I just brought in this brown paper packet, that's all. It's only polite to do people a favour, isn't it?"
I had looked into the paper bag, which at first glance seemed to contain nothing but bananas, but under the bananas was a tightly folded newspaper and a letter from Mrs. Boxall. After lights out, I stuffed both into my pyjama jacket and walked down the corridor to the lavatories. Taking the letter out, I began to read. It was written in Mrs. Boxall's neat librarian's hand.
"Dear P.K., much news from the war zone. I have been to see Mr. Andrews. He is the lawyer who comes into the library and only takes out books on birds. He read your notes and he said, 'By Jove, this place is a different complexion on everything.' He seemed very hopeful that he could get to the military judge when he arrives from Pretoria next Wednesday. He agrees with me. Your notes are excellent. 'Too good,' he said. 'Who will believe a 7-year-old can express himself in such detail?' Well, my dear, that's the problem he thinks we may have. He knows about your inability to speak, but he's hit on a clever plan. He wants you to take an intelligence test, a written test in front of the judge, so the judge can make up his own mind. Mr. Andrews has been to see your mother, but she won't hear of your having anything to do with the case. But she did say she'd pray about it, so all is not lost. It's a bit of a problem, really, but we're not beaten yet. I'm sure God is on our side, and not on the side of Georgie Hankin or the military. British justice will come through in the end, even if we have to write personally to Mr. Winston Churchill. Can you come and see me when you get out of hospital? Keep your chin up. Yours sincerely, Fiona Boxall, librarian.'
I wondered what sort of test the judge would give me. What if I failed and let Doc down? What if the Lord didn't give my mother permission for me to see the judge? But the Lord, with a little help from Mr. Andrews, who came from one of the oldest and most important families in town, came out in favour of my being a witness at the hearing. The lawyer had pointed out that it was very much in my mother's interests to clear our family name, as the prattletongues in town might well accuse her of neglect for having allowed me to roam the hills with a German spy. I was released from hospital on Tuesday, and on the following morning, Mrs. Boxall called round in Charlie, her little Austin Seven, to pick me up and take me down to the magistrate's court, where the military tribunal was to be held. Mr. Andrews was waiting for us, and so, to my surprise, was Marie.
"She seems to be the only one who can understand you, P.K., so we've brought her along as interpreter. It was my idea, and a good one, even if I say so myself," Mrs. Boxall declared.
Marie was dressed in a freshly starched nurse's uniform, and looked even more scared than I felt. Mr. Andrews left us, and we had to wait a long while, sitting on a bench in the waiting room. Finally, he came back and said the judge would see us privately in the magistrate's chambers, and depending on how things went, I wouldn't be required as a witness. None of this made very much sense to me, but we had to walk down a long corridor of cork lino that smelt of floor wax. A lady with a trolley full of teacups went rattling past us, and she stared at me. I was not yet used to people seeing me with my jaw wired up. I looked into every open door in the hope that I might see Doc. We finally reached a door with magistrate in gold lettering on a square of polished wood screwed to the door. Mr. Andrews knocked on it softly, and a voice said, "Come," and we followed him in. Sitting behind a desk was a man wearing a proper uniform with tie and polished leather Sam Brown belt. He stood up when we entered, and I could see he wore long pants and a revolver at his side. Mr. Andrews introduced him to us as Colonel de Villiers. There were four chairs arranged in front of the desk, and we all sat down. My notes were on the desk on top of a file that was tied with purple tape. Colonel de Villiers put on a pair of gold-rimmed spectacles, which slid down his nose as he looked up, so he looked over the top of them as he spoke. "Well now, young man, Mr. Andrews here tells me that you are bright enough to have written these notes." He tapped my notes with his forefinger. "How old are you?"
7, sir,
I rasped at the back of my throat. The Colonel, Mr. Andrews, and Mrs. Boxall turned to look at Marie. Her mouth opened, but nothing came out. Her whole face appeared to be frozen in terror, then two big tears squeezed out of her eyes. She tried again, but still nothing came out. I held up seven fingers to the Colonel, who looked stern and cleared his throat.
I see, seven. Well, you write very well for a seven-year-old. I think someone must have helped you, don't you?
I looked at Marie, who was sniffing into a hanky Mrs. Boxall had handed her. I shook my head.
"Hm,"
the Colonel grunted, and looked at Mr. Andrews.
These alleged swear words the sergeant is claimed to have said. They would seem an unlikely part of the vocabulary of a seven-year-old child, who, you tell me, has a religious background. I'm also a little surprised at his knowledge of Latin. Senecio serpens and glottifilum uncatum seem a little esoteric for a small boy, who I imagine, like all small boys, is more interested in getting his mouth around a sucker than a Latin noun.
Mrs. Boxall said, "The professor is an amateur botanist of considerable ability, and the child has been trained by him to take punctilious notes. Besides, he has almost perfect recall."
"Hm. A bit too perfect, if you ask me, madam," the Colonel said, as though talking to himself.
I could see Mrs. Boxall bristle.
"He did it all himself. I seen him do it in the hospital,"
Marie said suddenly, her voice quaking with terror.
"Well, that's one good thing. Little Miss Florence Nightingale has found her voice," the Colonel said. "Perhaps we can get on with the interview now."
He turned to me.
"Son, I want you to tell me the whole story again, just as it happened."
I repeated the story, although Marie had no chance of pronouncing the Latin names of the two succulents, which I then referred to as
blue chalksticks and another succulent genus, which I can write for you if you want.
The Colonel pushed a piece of paper across the desk, and I wrote the Latin names on it.
"Extraordinary. It seems I owe you an apology, madam," he said, dipping his head at Mrs. Boxall.
When we got to the swear words, Marie refused to say them.
"Please, sir, I can't say them words. I've never said words like that in my whole life," she said fearfully, but with absolute resolve.
The Colonel would cut in every once in a while and ask me questions such as,
"What was the colour of the sergeant's cap and belt?"
They were all questions which involved some minor piece of detailing, but I had no trouble answering them. When I was finished, he told Marie that she had done an excellent job, and she blushed crimson and the pimples stood out on her face. Then he turned to Mr. Andrews.
"The child's statement coincides almost precisely with that of the prisoner. We have already determined that neither has been in a position to compare notes, nor to have a third-party coordinated defense. Mrs. Boxall did try to see him, but was not allowed to do so. The prisoner has been visited and interviewed only by military personnel, and I am satisfied that the incident took place as the boy has alleged. I am quite sure the court will find for the defendant in all matters except one. I will ask that the charges of assault to a minor and attempted escape be withdrawn. Quite obviously, the striking of the provost sergeant was under severe emotional provocation, and the court is likely to look upon it as such. Both the army and the prison report state that the prisoner smelt heavily of whiskey, but we can quite easily ascertain whether his coat sleeve is stained."
He pulled at the purple tape on the file and opened it up. Inside were two folded copies of the Goldfield News, the picture of me sitting on the rock, and a number of Doc's other photographs, and also one of his small spiral-bound notepads. The Colonel held up one of the newspapers.
"Really, this kind of hysterical nonsense makes it very difficult for us. The trial of aliens is distressing enough without having the general population turning the butcher, the baker, and the music-maker into enemies of the state. The only charge Professor von Fallenstein faces is a technical one, that of having not registered as an alien."
He rose from his chair and smiled briefly at me.
"I only wish I could be here to have a chat with you when your jaw is better, young man. I am also beginning to form a healthy respect for the teachings of your professor.
He shook Mrs. Boxall and Mr. Andrews by the hand, and said something privately to him. Then Mr. Andrews hustled us out of the room. When we got back to the waiting room, Mr. Hankin of the Goldfield News was waiting. Mr. Andrews spoke to him, and he nodded towards the Colonel's office. Mr. Hankin rose and walked towards the office.
"I think Mr. Hankin's career as a spy-catcher is about to come to a sticky end," Mrs. Boxall said to me, and then started to laugh.
"We won, P.K. We won," she said triumphantly.
But we hadn't won. While Doc was acquitted of all the charges, just as the Colonel said he would be, he was charged with being an unregistered alien, and the court ordered him to be detained in a concentration camp for the duration of the war. The Goldfields News headline read, "No spy, but still a German." It was a year before Mrs. Boxall agreed to resume her column, Clippings from a Cultured Garden by Fiona Boxall. 11. Doc was to be kept in custody at the Barberton prison until arrangements could be made to send him to a concentration camp somewhere in the Highveld. 2 days after Doc had been sentenced, I went to the library to take a bunch of roses from my mother to Mrs. Boxall. Mr. Andrews had explained to my mother how my evidence had saved Doc from a severe sentence, one that might well have killed a man of his age. He had also persuaded her that we had nothing to be ashamed of, and that he only wished his 2 sons, now at boarding school in Johannesburg, had had the benefit of a man as remarkable as the professor. My mother decided that the Lord had guided her in the matter, and that his will had been quite clearly wrought through me. The roses to Mrs. Boxall were her sign that the librarian's trespass into the hospital to see me had been forgiven. Mrs. Boxall seemed excited when she saw me come through the door.
"I'm so fearfully glad you came, P.K. I have a letter for you."
I handed her the roses.
"How very nice of your mother."
She placed them on the book-sorting table and withdrew into her tiny office to return with a small blue envelope which she handed to me. The envelope was sealed, and I opened it carefully, pulling back the flap at the back, the glue giving way reluctantly.
"Do hurry, P.K. I can't bear the suspense," Mrs. Boxall said, looking over my shoulder.
I withdrew a single sheet of cheap exercise paper and opened it. Doc's neat hand covered the page.
"Oh, dear, I'm such an awful nosy Parker. May I read it with you?"
Besides Hoppy's note, it was the only letter I had ever received, and the first one sealed in an envelope. I would have preferred to read it alone, but of course I couldn't possibly say so, and I nodded my agreement.
"Dear P.K., what a mess we are in. Me in this place where they tear down a man's dignity, and you with a broken jaw. But things could be worse. I could be a black man, and that would be trouble and a half, absolute. I have been placed under open arrest. It means I can go anywhere in the prison grounds, and my cell is not locked. Best of all, it means I can have visitors. Will you come and see me? Ask Mrs. Boxall to telephone the people here and make arrangement. There's also good news about the Steinway. The Commandant is going to allow me to have it in the prison hall. This is good news, yeah? I do not think of myself as a German. What is a German? To say a man is a German, what is that? Does it tell you if he is a good man or a bad man? No, my friend. It tells you nothing about a man to say he is German. A man must think what he is inside. What he is on the outside. How can this matter? Also, because I am German, I am well treated by the warders. This also is stupid. Have you planted the Senecio serpent? No, of course not. I'm getting old and think only of my own welfare. Perhaps Mrs. Boxall will take the books in the cottage and put them in the library. In the meantime, I'm treated well, and whiskey is getting easier not to have. Please come soon. Your friend, Doc.
We will call the prison at once,
Mrs. Boxall said, inviting me into her office.
The superintendent of Barberton Prison, Commandant Yapi van Zyl,
told Mrs. Boxall that Colonel de Villiers had said Professor von Follenstein should be allowed access to the boy within the normal rules of the prison. He added that he had heard of my bravery and wanted to meet me himself. That if Mrs. Boxall cared to have me bring Doc library books, this would be permitted. The professor was a musician and a scholar, and Barberton Prison was honored to have him. Mrs. Boxall selected three botanical books she knew to be among Doc's favorites, and I set out with a note from her to visit Doc in prison. I arrived at the gates of the prison, which were made of wrought iron and locked with a huge chain and padlock. It was the biggest lock I had ever seen, nearly twice the size of a grown-up's hand. I wondered how big the key would have to be to open it. The gate seemed about 12 feet high, and along the top there were pipes welded every 2 feet or so. They were about 3 feet long, bent inward at a 30-degree slant, threaded with strands of barbed wire 6 inches apart, and set into huge blocks of blue granite. Without thinking, I identified the components of the rock, mainly feldspar and quartz, quarried in the Barberton district, so in addition it contained a fair amount of mica. After a year with Doc, it had become second nature to identify almost anything that didn't move, and I was an expert at the geology of the district. I decided that escape from inside the wall would be impossible. Set high up to the side of the gate was a church bell, and from it, hanging almost to the ground, was a rope. A sign fixed onto the wall said, "Ring for attention." My heart beat wildly as I tugged on the rope, and the noise from the bell seemed deafening as it cracked the silence. Almost immediately, a warder carrying a rifle slung over his shoulder came out of the guardhouse some 20 feet from the gate and walked towards me. His highly polished black boots made a scrunching sound on the white gravel driveway. I handed my note to him through the bars of the gate, and he opened it suspiciously. He looked at the note for a bit, and then looked up at me. "Praat jy Afrikaans?" he asked. I nodded my head, indicating to him that I understood Afrikaans. The swelling in my tongue had subsided, and while my voice had very little volume and sounded a bit gravelly, I could talk quite clearly through my wired-up mouth. The young guard looked relieved and started to talk in Afrikaans. He asked me to read the note as he didn't have much English, coming from the northwestern Transvaal where only the Taal is spoken.
"It says I am here to visit Professor von Follenstein and have permission from Commandant van Zyl," I told him.
"I will get on the telephone and ask. Better wait here, you hear?"
He walked over to the guardhouse and I could see him talking on the phone. He was quite young and looked nervous. Finally, he replaced the receiver and stuck his head out of the door.
"Come," he beckoned to me.
But the gate was locked, and he shook his head in exasperation and disappeared to return with a very large key on a huge ring. To my surprise, the gates opened smoothly and closed with a clang as he locked them behind me. The young warder told me to report to the office in the administration block and pointed it out to me.
"Tot ziens, and thanks for reading the note. You're a good girl," he said.
The area between the gate and the administration block was completely bare. Lawns stretched from either side of the gravel driveway for about 5 feet, and thereafter the square turned into a parade ground of sun-hardened red clay. The strip of living green on either side of the pathway was a brilliant though incongruous contrast to the baked earth of the parade ground and the dead blue-gray walls and buildings. I could see a warder's head in the window of a little tower built onto and jutting out from the wall. There was a stretch of walkway for 50 feet on either side of the tower. Two guards with rifles slung over their shoulders paced up and down this walkway. I seemed to be the only person on the ground below them, and I wondered how, on my way out, they'd know I wasn't a prisoner trying to escape. Maybe they'd give me a white flag to carry or something. It was one of the longest walks of my life. I could sense the oppression of the place, the terrible silence. Without trees, no cicadas hummed the air to life. No birds punctuated the stillness. My bare feet on the gravel made an exaggerated sound. There were tiny dark windows arranged 3 stories high. Each was divided by 2 vertical steel bars. I imagined hundreds of eyes hungrily devouring my freedom as they watched from the prison darkness. The door of the administration block was open, and after hesitating, I put my head around it. Inside was a small hallway that had the same wax-polished smell of the magistrates' courts. 3 benches, arranged like church pews, filled half the hallway, and there was a window with bars set into a wall. Through the bars I could see an office. I walked into the hallway and sat on the front bench and waited. I don't know how long I sat there, but it seemed to be a very long time. I could see two men in uniform pass the grill window occasionally, but they never looked out. I could hear them talking on the phone. After I'd been there for ages and ages, I heard the voice of a man on the phone behind the grill. He was shouting in Afrikaans and seemed very angry.
"He hasn't arrived, you dumb cop! Are you sure you directed him to this building? We can't have a bloody kid walking around the prison. It's been almost half an hour and there's no sign of him. We'll have to look for him now and it's all your bloody fault."
I could hear the receiver being slammed back into its cradle.
"Come,"
I heard the voice say to someone else. And a moment later, a door opened and a big man, followed by another big man who looked younger than the first one, came out. The big man saw me as he entered the hallway.
"Jesus Christ, where have you been?" he shouted at me.
"I've been here. I've been here all the time, Meneer,"
I rasped.
"Well, why didn't you make yourself known then?"
he asked in a slightly mollified voice, possibly because he had noticed my wire jaw. I pointed to the two notices on the wall behind the benches.
"It says on that notice, wait here, and on that other one it says silence,"
I replied fearfully. The younger of the two men suddenly laughed.
"I think the kid won the first round, Lieutenant," he said. "Okay, man. I admit you got me there fair and square," the older one chuckled. "Come, we must take down your name and things."
They led me into the office, and after taking my name, address, and age, the older one made a phone call and asked to speak to the commandant. Then he put the phone down.
"The commandant wants to see you, but he's doing an inspection now. We have to wait 20 minutes.
He turned to the younger warder.
"Klipkop, get PK here a cup of tea and a biscuit."
I wondered how someone could be called Klipkop. In Afrikaans, it meant Stonehead. But when I looked at the tall blonde man, his raw-boned features looked as if they could well have been carved out of stone. Klipkop rose and held out his hand.
"Seeing we're going to be here for a while, we might as well introduce ourselves. Odendaal, Jonas Odendaal," he said formally in the Afrikaans manner, giving his surname first, then repeating it attached to his Christian name.
"This is Lieutenant Smith." He indicated the older warder, who stretched out his hand without looking at me, and I took it briefly, blushing with embarrassment. I wondered whether Captain Smith was related to Jackhammer Smith, maybe his brother. But I didn't have the courage to ask. After all, Smith is a pretty common Afrikaans name. If he was, I hoped he was a better type than the miner.
"Come, I'll show you where we make tea," Klipkop said. "There's a kaffer who makes it, but if we want a cup in between, we make it ourselves. It's very handy. Every week we put in a shilling for milk and sugar and biscuits, but the authorities supply tea. You got to watch the kaffer or the black bastard pinches everything. I'm telling you, man, this place is full of thieves."
I followed him into a small kitchen behind the office, and he put water into an electric jug and plugged it in.
"PK, that's a name I haven't heard before."
"It's just a name I gave myself. That's my real name," I said.
"Yeah, I know, man, it's the same with me. They call me Klipkop because I box and can take any amount of head punches. Now sometimes I find it hard to remember my born name."
For a moment I was stunned.
"You box?"
I asked.
"Ach, yeah, man. In this place, if you want to get on, you have to box. But I like it anyway. On the weekend we travel all over the place to fight. It's much better than rugby, man."
He took 3 mugs down from a cupboard above the small sink.
"Lieutenant Smith is the boxing coach. She used to be a heavyweight."
He paused as he spooned a heaped tablespoon full of tea from a much-used tea caddy into the pot.
"But all the easy stuff is over now, man. Next month I have my first professional fight. There's good money in the fight game. I've got a nai in Sabi and we're thinking of getting married."
He poured the water from the electric jug into the tin teapot, and then stirred it with the tablespoon before placing the lid on the pot.
"Do you box, PK?"
He asked the question to be polite and did not expect my reaction. My heart was pounding as I spoke.
"No, but can you teach me, please, Meneer Odendaal?"
He looked at me in surprise and must have seen the pleading in my eyes.
First your jaw has got to get better. But I think you're a bit young, anyway. Lieutenant Smith teaches also the warders' kids, but I think the youngest in the junior squad is already 10 years.
I can be 10. I'm 10 in class already. I could be 10 in boxing easily, and my jaw will be better in 8 weeks, I begged.
Hey, whoa, not so fast. 10 is 10. On the form we wrote, you were 7 years old only.
If you fight first with the head and then with the heart, you can be 10 years old, I said.
Machtig, you're a hard one to understand, PK. You'll have to ask Lieutenant Smith, he's the boss. But if you ask me, I don't think you've got a snowball's hope in hell.
Will you at least ask him for me?
I rasped. The excitement made me overproject so that my throat was strained.
I'll ask him, man, but I already told you what he'll say.
He picked up the pot and poured tea into the 3 enamel mugs, added milk, 3 teaspoons of sugar, and stirred them all. He went to the cupboard and took out a tin and prized it open.
That bloody kaffir, we had nearly 1/4 of a packet of Marie biscuits in here, now they're all gone. It's time that black bastard went into a work gang. Take your cup and bring the milk, PK. If you come again, next time we'll have biscuits.
Please, Meneer Odendal, you won't forget to ask the lieutenant. You see, I've got to start boxing because I have to become the welterweight champion of the world.
I said it without thinking. It was more a thought expressed aloud than a statement. Clip-clop whistled.
Well, you're right, man. With an ambition like that, you've got to get started early.
He paused, 2 steaming cups in one hand, the teapot with the sugar bowl balanced where the teapot lid would normally have been in the other.
Me, I'll be happy if I can beat the lieutenant's brother in Nelspruit next month.
He turned and looked over his shoulder at me.
You can call me Clipcop if you like, I won't mind, man.
I followed him back into the office, where Lieutenant Smith was working on some papers. Clipcop put a mug of tea down in front of him.
PK wants to ask you something, Lieutenant, he said, and turned to me. Ask him, man.
Lieutenant Smith hadn't looked up from his papers, but he gave a short grunt.
Please, sir, will you teach me how to box?
I asked, my voice down to a tiny squeak. He still didn't look at me, but instead lifted the tea to his lips, and first, blowing the steam from the surface, took a sip from the mug.
You're too young, PK. In 3 years come back, then we will see.
He was taller than me even when he was sitting down, and now he looked down at me.
We read about you in the paper. You have lots of guts. That's a good start. But you're not even big for 7 like a boor kid.
He ruffled my hair.
Soon you will be 10. Just you watch.
At that moment an African came into the room. He was quite old and looked very thin, wearing the coarse, knee-length grey canvas pants and shirt of a prisoner. In his hand he held the teapot lid.
I have come to make tea, Baas, but the pot, she's not here,
he said slowly in Afrikaans. He stood with his head bowed. In 2 bounds, Clipcop had reached him, and grabbing him by the front of his canvas shirt, he lifted the African off his feet and gave him a tremendous swipe across the face. The blow landed with a loud, flat sound, and the black man's face seemed to squash in slow motion as Clipcop's huge hand landed on the side of his nose and mouth. Clipcop released his grip, and the man fell at his feet, whimpering.
You black bastard, you stole the Marie biscuits! Not just one, you piece of dog shit, you stole them all!
He gave him a kick in the rump.
No, Baas. Please, Baas. I not stole biscuit. A good boy, Baas,
the old man pleaded, and still holding the teapot lid, he locked his free arm around Clipcop's ankles. The warder turned to Lieutenant Smith.
Please, Lieutenant, can't we transfer this black bastard to the stone quarry? First he steals sugar, now the Marie biscuits.
He looked down at the whimpering African at his feet. Blood from the prisoner's nose had dripped onto the shiny toe of his boot. Clipcop kicked him loose, sending the black man flying against the wall where he hit the back of his head with a thud, the teapot lid clattering to the floor at his side.
He's bleeding on me, the filthy black shit-ass is bleeding all over my boots.
He thrust one foot towards the dazed African slumped against the wall.
Lick it off, kaffir! Make quick!
The stunned man bent over the proffered boot and licked the blood from the toe cap. Then, without being told, did the same with the other boot, at the same time holding his hand up to his nose to prevent further blood spilling on the warder's boots.
"Now wipe your filthy black spit off my boots, you black bastard. I don't want foot and mouth disease."
Lieutenant Smert, who hadn't even looked up, grinned at the joke. The African removed his canvas shirt and, trying to sniff back the blood, commenced to wipe Klipkop's boots with it.
"On the floor also,"
the warder said, pointing to several scarlet drops of blood on the floor. The black man wiped the drops of blood from the green linoleum floor.
"Now get up and clear out, you bastard."
The African scrambled to his feet, and Klipkop gave him a flying kick which sent him sprawling again. Crawling on all fours, his shirt clutched in one hand, the black prisoner fled from the room. Klipkop examined his hand.
"They got heads made of bloody cannonballs,"
he grinned.
"I'm learning, man. Notice I didn't hit him this time with my fist."
He turned to me.
"Always remember, when you hit a kaffir, stay away from his head. You can break your fist on their heads just like that. Hit him in the face, that's all right, but never on the head, man."
He made a fist and rubbed it into the palm of his hand.
"I got a big fight coming up. I can't afford a broken fist from a stinking kaffir's head."
Lieutenant Smith hadn't said a word. He took another sip from his tea.
"We can't send him to the quarry, man. He's had the rheumatic fever, he'd die in a week. Besides, he's the first kaffir we've had who can make proper coffee and tea."
He pointed at the cup in front of him.
"Not like this shit. I told you not to stir it and to warm the pot first."
He turned to look at Klipkop, with just the hint of a smile on his face.
"Next time, man, ask before you hit. I ate the Bloody Marie biscuits. I never had breakfast this morning, so I ate them."
Klipkop's mouth fell open, and then he grinned.
"Okay, so I hit him because he steals the sugar. What's the difference?"
The phone rang, and Lieutenant Smith picked it up and listened for a moment.
"Right," he said into the receiver, and replaced it. He turned to me. "The commandant is back. Come on, son."
Grabbing Mrs. Boxall's books, I followed the lieutenant up a set of stairs to the second floor. We entered a small outer office where a lady sat behind a desk typing on a big black machine which had Remington Corona in gold letters on its back.
"Go right in, Lieutenant Smith. The commandant is waiting for you," she said, smiling at me.
We entered a large office, dark brown and filled with dead animals. A kudu head was mounted directly behind the commandant's desk, with a sable antelope head beside it, the elegant curved horns touching the wall. There were gemsbok and eland heads to complete the display of larger antelope, and next to them, in a cluster of five heads, were the smaller variety of buck. Grey duiker, klipspringer, steenbok, reebok, and springbok. I turned to face the wall behind me, for it too was covered in trophies. This time a large black-maned lion looked down at me, mouth in the full roar position. Next to it were a leopard and a cheetah. All the carnivores were on one side of the door, while on the other were their most common prey, a zebra and a black wildebeest. Below these, fixed to brackets on the wall, were a Boer Mauser and a British Lee Metford. Immediately below these two Boer War rifles was a long-shafted Zulu-throwing assegai. The rest of the wall space was taken up with small framed pictures, mostly of hunting parties standing over dead animals. The room was furnished with two heavy leather club chairs and a large matching sofa, and on the polished floorboards were a zebra and a lion skin. Directly behind the commandant's head and below the kudu and sable antelope hung two large portraits. One was of King George and the other of President Paul Kruger, the last president of the defeated Boer Republic. The picture of the Boer president was in an elegant oval walnut frame. King George looked to be the sort of official photograph in a cheap gilt frame issued to public institutions and requiring mandatory display. Commandant Van Zyl rose from behind his desk, which was really a large ball and claw dining room table with a sheet of glass covering its surface. There was nothing on the table except the pad on which he appeared to be writing, his fountain pen, and an ashtray.
Good morning, Smith. Sit down, please.
He turned to look down at me.
So, this is the boy, eh?